Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Unheard, I'm Freddie Sayers. Have you noticed that certain big figures from Silicon Valley are starting to take a strongly dissenting line over the war in Ukraine? Elon Musk has caused quite a storm by suggesting that a deal with Vladimir Putin needs to be done urgently, even if it involves surrendering parts of eastern Ukraine. All of this is to avoid the risk of nuclear conflict. He's not the only one. David Sachs was another co-founder of PayPal alongside Elon Musk. In fact, he was the COO of PayPal, and he and Elon Musk have been mutually tweeting each other on the topic of Ukraine. Now he is founder and general partner at Kraft Ventures, and he is a co-host of the hit podcast All In. Happily, he joins us from California to tell us a bit more. Hi, David.
Hey, Freddie. Good to be with you.
Before we get started with David Sachs, a quick word of thanks to our sponsors for this episode of Unheard TV, Macro Hive. Macro Hive is a leading provider of investment research that has now become one of the most respected and independent voices in finance. They offer insights into everything from geopolitics to inflation and central bank policy, and their clients are wealth managers and private investors. Now, more than ever, protecting investments and making smart long-term decisions is crucial. So they've created something called Macro Hive Lite, which is a free weekly newsletter where their pros cover the biggest stories and reveal trade ideas on stocks, FX, commodities, and more. If you like the sound of that and would like to sign up, just visit macrohive.com. It goes without saying that Macro Hive is an independent organization and does not subscribe necessarily to any of the views expressed in this episode. Now, back to David Sachs. So let's just start by trying to understand what your position on Ukraine actually is, because it's been quite controversial the past few weeks. You published a piece, I think it was in Newsweek, called Woke War 3, which basically laid out how you felt some political ideas are leading us in quite a dangerous direction. Give us your position as you would set it out.
Right. Well, my concern is that, let's call them woke cancellation tactics, are being used to silence a part of this debate or discussion, which is how do we find a diplomatic solution to end this Ukraine war? And if you put forward any idea for a peace settlement, then you are portrayed as being a Putin sympathizer or sycophant or something like that. You saw that with Elon. He put forward this pretty reasonable peace proposal that I think the contours of which have been defined for over a year. Many people have put forward a proposal like that. And in fact, Zelensky seemed to be entertaining proposals like that at the beginning of the war. And yet, he was denounced as being sort of this Putin puppet. And in fact, even I think Anne Applebaum and David Frum accused him of actually being a messenger for the Kremlin without any evidence whatsoever. This is pretty standard stuff, even though Elon and his company SpaceX have given Starlink to the Ukrainian war effort at an out-of-pocket cost to themselves of $20 million a month. So there's very little room right now in the public conversation to even raise the idea of a negotiated settlement. And my view on it is that proposing peace or a negotiation is not pro-Russian. We should be looking to do what's in the American interest. I'm not on the Russian side or the Ukrainian side per se. I'm on the American side.
Essentially, the idea of proposing a peace settlement has become morally unacceptable.
Right, right. You're accused of being on the Russian side if you suggest any form of negotiated peace. And I just think that's not right. I mean, we'd never get to any negotiated peace in any conflict if you had that attitude that it would be serving only the other side's interests.
So are you, roughly with Elon in terms of trying to understand what kind of settlement you think would be logical? He tweeted out a map of a recent political result which showed a very clear divide within Ukraine between kind of more Russian sympathizing areas, the implication being that might form the sort of baseline for some kind of partition almost of Ukraine. And that, of course, was highly controversial. Are you with Elon on that?
Well, I think there's three regions of Ukraine that are going to need to be dealt with separately if you want to create a lasting peace here. So you've got the western portion of the country, called the western 80 or 90%, which is more aligned with the West. You then got this eastern part, this Donbass region, call it 10 to 20% of the country, that is ethnically divided and has been the location of a civil war that's gone back roughly 8 years. And you're going to need a different solution for that area. And then finally, you've got Crimea, which is majority Russian, ethnically Russian. Something like 60% of the population consider themselves to be Russian. Three quarters of Crimea, in polling that was done by Gallup and a German polling company back in 2015, said that they wanted to go with Russia. And Crimea was annexed by Russia in 2014. That's sort of a fait accompli. So I think that the start of a negotiated settlement would be to realize that the three regions are very different in terms of their history and ethnicities. And if you want to actually create a lasting peace, you're going to have to deal with each of these separately. So I think the broad contours of a deal, I think, have been understood for some time, which is for the western part of the country, you'd invest in economic development. Ukraine could become part of the EU. Putin, for what it's worth, has said that Ukraine could become part of the EU. But you would take NATO expansion off the table because Russia perceives that as a threat. With respect to Crimea, you recognize the fait accompli that Crimea was annexed by Russia in 2014. The majority of people who live there want to go with Russia. That's not appeasement. That is self-determination. And then with respect to Donbass, I mean, the issue there is just it's one of these sort of messy, ethnically divided areas, and no solution is going to fully satisfy everybody there. That's why there's been an ethnic civil war going back 8 years there.
Could we be looking for there? Because I think my sense is that Crimea is less controversial to talk about. Even people who are very, very supportive of the kind of Western efforts in Ukraine, if you press them, will accept that there's no realistic chance of Crimea suddenly becoming a normal part of Ukraine anytime soon. But the Donbass is really the sort of conflict within Western conversations, because what do you do with it? Does it just become part of Russia? Does it become some special administrative zone, in which case who administers it? This is where people fall down.
Well, we had a solution for this under the Minsk Accords, which basically said that the Donbass region would remain part of Ukraine, but they'd have substantial autonomy. And the problem is, one of the problems leading up to this war is that Ukraine and the United States did not ultimately support the implementation of Minsk. And so, for example, you got laws passed in Kyiv to ban the speaking of Russian in that part of the country. And so The problem is we've had workable solutions for Donbass that involved that region staying part of Ukraine but with substantial autonomy, and they weren't respected. I don't think there is necessarily a perfect solution for this region, and I think the question for the United States is, what are we willing to accept, what's in our interest?
My question, I guess, would be at this point, is that really an option that Putin would accept anymore, to say those parts would still be part of Ukraine but there'll be special privileges? Doesn't feel like it from the rhetoric coming out of Moscow.
Right. Perhaps not. I mean, perhaps not. I think that we could have had a solution to this conflict much more easily a year ago, and we never took advantage of those opportunities for diplomacy. So the solution you're likely to get now may be worse. I think that's entirely correct.
Give us a hint. What do you think we might be looking at now?
Well, I guess it depends on how things go on the ground. But the question really should be, what's acceptable to the United States of America? And the reality is that the United States does not have a vital interest in who rules the Donbass, whether it's a Ukrainian oligarch or a Russian oligarch who ultimately presides there. We should just want to find a solution, a settlement that is basically acceptable to the people who live there. And the settlement is always going to be a little bit messy because this is one of those ethnically divided areas a la the Balkans where people have been in a civil war with each other. And I understand that Russia's been fueling that by funding separatists in those in that region. But ultimately, I think there should be a range of outcomes here that are acceptable to the United States.
So that's almost like the kind of it's a more traditional way of resolving a regional dispute where essentially the grand powers get together and carve it up and say, well, to stop this escalating, let's just do this. And whether the local people are happy about it 100% or not doesn't.
Well, no, I think I don't think we're the ones carving it up. I think the principle here is we should broadly follow what the people of that area want. I mean, the principle here should be self-determination, not appeasement. And it's not about us carving it up. It's about what are we willing to accept? Because the fact of the matter is that we could have avoided this war if we were willing to take NATO expansion off the table and recognize the Minsk Accords. So it's not like the United States has just been sitting on the sidelines. The Biden administration has sort of this passive-aggressive framing that, oh, we just need to support whatever the Ukrainians want, that you know we're not really involved in this. But the truth of the matter is that we've been highly involved in this region since 2014, if not before. We gave support to the Maidan Revolution or coup, depending on what you want to call it. And we refused to give support to the Minsk Accords that could have resolved this conflict in eastern Ukraine. So we have been very involved there and trying to convert Ukraine into a member of NATO and into a Western bulwark on Russia's border is a long-term project of our State Department. And our actions there have helped pressurize this situation. And now we pretend like we just have to defer to our client Zelensky and basically do whatever he wants. That's a charade.
I mean, so your view then is basically we should extract and stop being so involved and essentially leave to the future of Ukraine to whatever happens in the region. It shouldn't be an American priority to dictate the terms.
Well, no American president has ever asserted that the United States has a vital interest in Ukraine or any part of Ukraine. It's simply not. Even Biden himself, at the beginning of the war, made clear that we would not get directly involved in the fighting. He rejected a no-fly zone, which would have required us to shoot down Russian planes. And even when goaded by the press, remember that interview with Lester Holt at the beginning of the war, where Biden was asked, you know, Mr. President, what if there's Americans trapped behind enemy lines? Would you send in our troops to go get them? And Biden said, no, we won't, because we cannot risk a shooting war with Russia. So at the beginning of this war, we were very clear that the U.S. would not get directly involved because we did not have an interest that rose to the level of a vital interest. And yet, here we are 8 or 9 months later, and we've been going down this slippery slope, and people are so, I guess, swept up in the war fever and in their moral condemnation of the Russian side that we've been getting progressively more and more involved.
Let's try to work out what's really going on then. Where do you think this war fever really originates? There's a few different arguments flying around. I want to throw a couple your way and see how you respond to them. The first is a sort of practical realpolitik argument, which a lot of people make in defense of this, which is if you give him an inch, he'll take a mile, basically. If Vladimir Putin senses weakness on the part of the West and that we essentially surrender or lose interest, other areas like whether it's Poland or the Baltic states or some part of Asia would now become vulnerable. What do you say to that argument?
Well, a couple of things. So I understand that's the dominant narrative, is that this war began on February 24th. There was no prehistory to it. Vladimir Putin just went nuts on February 24th and indulged his desire for imperial conquest and to try and reincorporate Ukraine into a greater Soviet Union or Russian Empire. I understand that's the dominant narrative. And in that framing, Putin is the second coming of Hitler. And if we basically give him 1 square inch of territory, it's only going to whet his appetite. That would be appeasement. I think there's a couple of problems with that. The first is that, first of all, if the Ukraine war has shown anything, it is that Russia is not strong enough. They're not militarily capable enough to pose a threat to all of Europe. Even before the war, it was the case that Russia's economy was 1/10 the size of the EU's, and his population was roughly a third, and his life expectancy was much lower. It was an aging population that wasn't even replacing itself at sort of reproducing at replacement rate. So this idea that Russia posed a threat to all of Europe or to NATO, I think, was always threat inflation. It simply didn't have the capabilities, even if Putin had the intent. But that kind of brings me to the second point, which is I fundamentally have questions about that narrative, because I don't think this conflict started on February 24th. If you go back and look at experts, the sort of realist camp, who were writing about this issue going back to 2014 and even the late 90s, they were raising the specter that the West's attempt to bring NATO right up to Russia's front porch would ultimately be seen by Moscow as a provocation and result in a poisoning of relations between the West and Russia, and could eventually lead to a conflict, a war. And the problem is just that those thinkers, those IR scholars, simply
aren't listening to. This is John Mearsheimer and that group.
Yeah, I mean, you go back all the way to the late 90s, and you've got George Kennan, the architect of our Cold War containment policy, who said that expanding NATO eastward all the way up to Russia's front porch would be a tragic mistake that would create hostility within Russia, could even.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Lead to the rise of a strong man. And that when we finally got in a conflict with them, Kennan predicted that we would say, see, the Russians were always like that. So then in 2008, when we issued the Bucharest Declaration that we intended to bring Ukraine into NATO, you had our own ambassador to Russia, who is now the CIA director, Bill Burns, write his famous memo back to the then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the memo Nyet means Nyet, saying that bringing Ukraine into NATO is a red line for all Russian elites, not just Putin. And then in 2014, you had IR scholars like Mearsheimer and Kissinger basically say that the solution here to de-escalate the crisis is to declare that Ukraine should be neutral. It should not be brought into NATO. Instead, we should pursue economic development for Ukraine, but that militarily, Ukraine needed to remain a buffer state between the West and Russia, because our attempts to bring them into NATO was seen as threatening to Moscow. And so
the, I guess the argument then is, given that more complex reading of the history, where there was risk-taking and threatening taking place on both sides, it becomes like a risk-reward calculation, that actually the risk of continuing to prosecute the war in this manner ends up being greater than the risk of stepping back and seeing what happens. Is that how you think of it?
I guess there's just this fundamental question about what is motivating Moscow. What is motivating this Russian aggression? There's no question that Russia has engaged in this invasion. It's barbaric. It's heinous. The question is why. And the only narrative you'll hear in the media is this idea that it's motivated by these imperial dreams, or maybe sort of this kleptocracy, like Putin is just going to steal whatever he can. But I think there is this alternate reading of the situation by this sort of realist camp, the Mearsheimer, and also people like Jeffrey Sachs, the international development economist, who say, well, no, actually the motivation here is Russian insecurity, their historic sense of vulnerability and paranoia that we've been fueling by bringing American troops, weapons, and bases right onto their most vulnerable border, which is Ukraine.
Are there some strategic interests that benefit the United States that are actually served by this? I mean, do you think this, whether it is increased gas sales to Europe or whether it is the defense industry or whatever, do you have any sympathy with that view that actually there is kind of, there's an appetite for war within the American establishment?
I don't know ultimately if that's the motivation. Hanlon's razor says never attribute to malice what you can attribute to stupidity. I think it may just be obtuseness and stubbornness and a refusal to put yourself in the other guy's shoes, which should be the fundamental principle for diplomats. I think it could be all of those things really playing into this decision. But there's no question there's interest groups in Washington who do see a larger aim here.
You've put forward the argument that there's a collaboration between the woke left, as you call it, with a kind of warmongering right. Do you think there's any chance of a kind of parallel horseshoe politics happening at the same time? I mean, there are still some voices from the old anti-war left. And then, of course, you have people like Tucker Carlson on the so-called new right in the US who are also against it. Do you think there's a parallel sort of left-right alliance potentially going on there?
Well, I'd hope that to be the case, but just in the last few days, you had this spectacle of 30 progressive members of the House put out this letter, which was a very tepid letter, simply calling for the opening of a diplomatic track in parallel to our virtually unlimited support militarily for Ukraine. And in response to this, this letter provoked such a furor that virtually all of the signers renounced the letter within less than a day. Again, it didn't question our policy towards Ukraine. It didn't say that we weren't going to support them militarily. It just said that let's open a diplomatic channel with Russia to help avoid the potential risk of nuclear war. And even that relatively anodyne letter had to be denounced. And the signatories, virtually all of them, disavowed it. So, unfortunately, there is no more anti-war left, as far as I can tell. The member of Congress who you'd expect to be the most vocal, outspoken critic of the war would be someone like Bernie Sanders. And Sanders basically has totally embraced it and has no criticisms whatsoever of our conduct in the war, our support for Ukraine, or how we got here. So there doesn't seem to be much of a anti-war left.
Yeah. Why do you think it's left to people like you and indeed Elon Musk and some of these sort of big tech spokespeople? Why do you think it's that group that has become the vocal group of dissent? It's not necessarily what you'd expect. What's the sort of ideological or political reason for that?
I think it's simply that we're not part of this foreign policy establishment that is very clubby and sort of an insider's club where you have to have the right view in order to advance your career and get a job in the State Department or a think tank. We're not beholden to any of that. We're not beholden to the military industrial complex. We can just say what we think. And in my case, it's really just a result of me reading widely about this issue and discovering that there were all these thinkers in this realist school who again predicted the crisis. They foresaw what would happen. And I just think that this theory provides a much more complete explanation of what's happening, and therefore it provides, I think, a clearer understanding of how we get out of this situation before it could escalate into something even more tragic than what's already occurred.
I guess you've also got wealth and position, and you're hard to cancel. And Elon Musk, obviously, even more so. Do you think that has something to do with it? That now it's these kind of big barons who are powerful enough to say what they really think because they're not afraid of, as you call it, the woke mob?
Well, ironically, there are plenty of wealthy tech elites who are afraid to say what they really think because they're afraid of losing status. It's a different kind of game. But you're right that it does take a certain kind of person who's just willing to say what they think and not really care whether they get denounced by this online mob.
Do you think you're winning the argument? I mean, I don't know what the atmosphere is where you are in California. Do you feel like people are sort of turning their shoulder and are upset by what you've said publicly, or are people secretly supportive? I mean, sometimes in these scenarios where there's like a heavy censorship price to pay, people say, well, actually, I kind of agree with you, but I wouldn't want to say it publicly. What is your experience? Do you think there is a body of support for your view?
Yeah, I think that there is more support than is probably there is a body of support that may not be willing to speak out publicly because there is such pressure here not to say anything that could be construed and get you labeled as being pro-Putin or whatever. I mean, these intimidation tactics that are being used are real, and so I think they do have an effect. I have no doubt that the majority of the American people have no interest in getting in a nuclear war with Russia over any part of Ukraine. So I have no doubt that the opinions I hold are common sense among the American people, but they are not. They are actively discouraged and silenced and intimidated among the media and the sort of the foreign policy elite.
Final question for you, which is a little bit moving on from Ukraine, but it's relevant because we recently had this controversy over PayPal that was going to fine people who had broken their terms of service or had indulged in misinformation, I think was the crime. They then withdrew that, but it fits into this pattern where big technologies, such as the one you helped to create, are now weaponized or employed in disciplining a party line and making sure that it's enforced. What's your view on that? How dangerous is it, and do you think there's any way of reversing it?
Well, it's ironic that at the same time we say we're in a global struggle against autocracy and authoritarianism, that we increasingly are embracing authoritarian tactics at home. You're seeing increasing censorship. You see people within the Democratic Party basically say they don't support free speech anymore. You see financial deplatforming, like what PayPal is doing, based on people's political viewpoints. If you don't have the correct views according to them, they're going to cut you off from the financial system. They're going to prevent your ability to take payments or presumably earn a living. They're basically, these are tactics to starve out the opposition, not just silence through revoking their speech rights, but also to potentially take away their right to make a living. So you're seeing these increasing authoritarian tactics at home, and it's all justified in the name of democracy. And so you've had this weird fusion, I think, under the Biden presidency. Biden has basically declared that we are engaged in a global struggle against autocracy, both at home and abroad. He sort of fused this sort of foreign policy and domestic policy into this Manichaean struggle against dictatorship anywhere in the world. But the problem with that is that anything we don't like is labeled dictatorship. So it can be even democratically elected leaders like Viktor Orban, who I think has won 3 times in Hungary, or Meloni in Italy, or even Donald Trump, that is basically a threat to democracy, even though they're democratically elected. And then meanwhile, these authoritarian tactics like unprovoked invasions or sanction regimes or censorship or deplatforming or selective prosecution, these things are all justified in the name of democracy. So
But do you see yourself as part of a fight back against this? And should we be hopeful, do you think, that if, for example, the Musk deal to take over Twitter goes through, it may even have gone through by the time this video airs, do you think that is the beginning of a fight back and that some sort of alternative, more pro-free speech, pro-freedom media might come about.
Yeah, that's the hope for sure, is that this is the beginning of a pushback against this wave of censorship and deplatforming. I am concerned with this larger movement that's taking place here, which is that our civil liberties are increasingly jeopardized by, again, what Biden has labeled this global struggle that, again, he perceives as being both domestic and foreign. And it's really scary to think about the ways in which the security state could be applied to domestic political opposition. And we've seen hints of this. You saw that the Homeland Security Department had that attempt to create basically a ministry of truth, that they were going to create an organization to define disinformation. This is the part of our government that has domestically has all the guns. And for them to be just defining what misinformation is, and then they included this idea of misinformation in their definition of terrorism. So there have been these hints and warnings that the powers of the state are going to be used to crack down on domestic political opposition. And again, it's framed in this sort of Manichaean way that is somehow part of this global struggle. And of course, anybody who wants to raise a question about what we're doing in Ukraine is labeled pro-Putin, and the domestic opposition is labeled pro-Putin as well. So it's this scary metastasizing of our culture war into something, I think, much more dangerous. You know, a lot of people thought that the culture war was just sort of this sideshow and wasn't really relevant to our politics, but now it has sort of metastasized into something, I think, much scarier.
I know I said the last one was the final question. This is the final question. Which way do you think it's going to go? Because you've talked about the beginnings of a fight back, but then there's a lot of establishment power on the side of this more authoritarian sort of moral clarity way of seeing things. You're not a, you know, sage. You can't necessarily predict the future, but right. What's your instinct? Do you think the fight back will win? Do you think this way of seeing the world will break down? Or do you think we're headed for more authoritarian times down the road?
Well, this is the big battle. And I think it depends on how the battle is met and how it's resisted. And I do think that Elon buying Twitter, if that succeeds, will be helpful in the sense that Elon has said that he believes in free speech, not censorship. And hopefully that'll inspire other people to push back against these authoritarian tendencies in the West. And to be clear, I'm no fan of authoritarianism. I think it's a very unattractive feature of government. I'm not a fan of authoritarianism in Russia, for example. I just don't know that we need to be declaring war all over the world against it. I think what we should be doing is focusing on our own politics and maintaining our own civil liberties and freedoms. That should be the first priority. And again, it would be ironic if in our zeal, in our crusade to battle authoritarianism abroad, that we give up our fundamental civil liberties at home. Our rights to free speech, our rights to make a living, our rights to be free from political prosecution. And increasingly, those things are at risk. And they're at risk because we have a party that's in control of our government that sees these causes as synonymous. That's very scary.
David Sacks, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks, Freddie.
That was David Sacks, Silicon Valley mogul, co-founder and COO back in the day of PayPal, now a big investor in Silicon Valley, and alongside Elon Musk, one of the more vocal voices for a different way of approaching the Ukraine question. Whether you agree with him or not, it seems fair that he should be heard. He's a serious guy, and I certainly found it interesting. Hope you did too. This was Unheard.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinis. I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.